You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
By any imaginable standard, Trevor Noah has had a remarkable life. He grew up under apartheid in South Africa with a black mother and white father. He has gone from being a petty criminal as a teenager in the slums called Alex to an international comedy sensation. And he arrived as the host of The Daily Show just in time to give us some much-needed inside-outside perspective on the bizarre political events unfolding in this country. His memoir, Born a Crime, is published by Spiegel & Grau, and Trevor's most recent comedy special, Afraid of the Dark, is currently available on Netflix. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
The first time you were here was in 2013, and you were performing in a relatively small venue at the Lynn Redgrave Theater downtown. I'd barely heard of you. Are you amazed at how your career has changed since then? We're talking 4 years.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen time that way. You know, some people say it's fast, but when you're in it, I never feel like it's a long time or a short time, just because you're always working. You're always working towards something. So I acknowledge the great leaps and bounds that I've made, and I don't think I take for granted any day where I've gotten to in my life.
Given the life that you've lived, is it just another routinely unbelievable turn of events?
I think because of my mom's life and because of the story, you know, that my mother imbued within me, I guess I believed always that anything was possible. I always pursued things that I was never meant to pursue, and I always believed that I could end up where no one thought I should. So, as you know, I'd never take it for granted, but I also believe that anything is possible.
Much of this book is about you and your mother.
Yes.
The show that brought you to our attention in 2013 was also called Born a Crime, and I thought the book might be a literary version of that, but the book is much more, and not just in terms of the story of your life, but also about the system of apartheid. You say that apartheid was perfect racism.
Yeah, in many ways it was. You know, if you look at the architects of apartheid and what they did in South Africa, they didn't settle for basic racism as many places did in the world. They went out and they studied it. I mean, they were so dedicated to this system that they studied it in America. They studied systems in Australia. They studied in the Netherlands, where the word apartheid comes from. And they looked for the best ways to oppress people of color. And they did it in such a way that in the end, even black people were hating other black people, which was really something that you didn't see achieved with such precision anywhere else in the world.
It's interesting that they named a government policy apartness, in effect. Mm-hmm. How strange was the system of categorization? Is it true that under apartheid, Chinese were considered black and Japanese were considered white?
Yeah, that is true. So what happened was racism, we have to acknowledge first and foremost, has no logic. So you have to construct rules that somehow conform to a logic that you invent, because these are not real things. So the government at the time said, okay, we have black people. They are the lowest of the low. And the lighter your skin gets, the more privileges you have in society. And so if you were an Indian person, you were considered above a black person, but below a white person. If you were mixed race, you know, half black, half white, then you were above black people but still below white people and above Indian people because of your shade. And then when Chinese people were introduced into the country in larger numbers, people didn't know where to put them. And so the government said, oh, no, we're going with black for you. You're black. We don't care. The Japanese, though, would have suffered the same fate were it not for the fact that Japan at the time was the world's biggest producer of TVs and electronics and cars that were sweeping the world. And so the government, fearing retribution from the Japanese, gave Japanese people in South Africa honorary white status, they called it. And that's how insane the system was.
But it got very complicated, as your life would suggest.
Yes.
Because you would be called colored, you'd be called mixed race.
Yeah, well, colored.
How many categories were
so
there?
So colored was the only thing. You know, mixed race is a term that I guess now we've started to use and it's more, more readily used in the world. But in South Africa, the best way I can explain colored is this. Colored was a term that they had to come up with because people were breaking the law. And the law was the law of miscegenation. And that was that black and white people should not have carnal intercourse with one another. No sex between the different races. But people break rules. And, you know, as much as people claim that there are differences, people find attractions. And so then children are born. And then what do they call these children? And very quickly they realized if you just label these children as black, as, you know, America did with the one drop rule, you're now building up a majority. So rather create a new race that you can then control and inform differently. And so they said that was colored. And then colored people were forced to be with colored people. And over generations, South Africa, in essence, created a new race of people. So I would consider myself mixed race. In South Africa, they'd call me colored, but I'd go, I'm colored by color, but not by culture. Because my parents, my mother is black, my father is white. Many colored people in South Africa have two colored parents, and then their grandparents may even be colored as well.
But as the title of your book suggests, you were born a crime.
I was.
Now, when it first arrived in our office, we knew immediately that we wanted to book you. But having read it, the guest I would really like to have booked is your mother.
You know, Leonard, everybody says that to me because here's what happened. I wrote a book in which I assumed I would come off as the hero because everyone assumes that they are the hero of their story. And when I was done compiling the essays and going through my childhood up to early adulthood, I came to realize that I wasn't the hero. My mom was the hero of my story or this story that I was telling. And I was just her punk-ass sidekick. And I was lucky enough to be on this journey with her.
Is it true, as it seems from the book, that she had no fear?
I think my mother has very little fear. You know, I think at one point it was maybe just stubbornness and ambition. But I know, you know, growing older, my mom has galvanized that with religion. My mother is one of the most fearless human beings I've ever come across in my life. She did what no one was doing when she was doing it. I mean, my mother was trying to work in white companies when that wasn't allowed. My mother was studying typing and secretarial courses when black people couldn't have a job that wasn't menial labor.
How was she even able to do that?
She just forced. She found a way. You know, she would find a loophole. She would find someone who was willing. It's the same way she had an apartment in a whites-only building because she found a man who I believe was Portuguese or Greek. And because he was a foreigner, he didn't care about the rules. He wanted to make money. And so my mom convinced him to rent the place to her. And he said, but what if you get caught? She said, that's my business. You just rent this place to me.
She'd been sleeping in all-night bathrooms, toilets before then.
Yeah.
There's a bit in your new stand-up special, Afraid of the Dark, where someone tries to get you to do something by calling you a pussy, and you say you wish you were as tough as some women. You must have been thinking about your mother.
Oh, definitely. You know, that whenever someone says that phrase, I laugh at how we've convinced ourselves that somehow, you know, a pussy is a weak image that, you know, that people want to connote. So they say, oh, don't be a pussy. And I go, no, I wish I was, you know. If anything, people should say, don't be a penis. You know, that's what I've learned in my life. I grew up in a world where my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, these were the strongest people. I grew up in a society that partly because of, you know, we were robbed of males because of apartheid, because of the working system and because of how people were shipped off to work in mines. I grew up in a matriarchal society.
And was that all that unusual to be brought up by your mother without a father present?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I used to consider myself privileged because I still had contact with my father. I grew up with many friends who never got to know their fathers, friends who had their fathers killed in the struggle against apartheid, friends whose fathers were exiled, friends whose fathers were imprisoned, you know, fighting for freedom. And I was lucky, I always consider myself lucky, that I got to see my father maybe once or twice a month. And so in my world, living without a father was the only way people lived.
My guest is Trevor Noah, who has written a book called Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood. How big was your mother's family? Why did she decide to go to live with her father when she was a child?
Well, my mom always said to me that, you know, she always craved the love of her father. You know, my grandfather was a charming, charismatic, big, he was a big figure. wonderful personality that just really emanated everywhere he went. And my mom really loved him. And she didn't get along with my grandmother. And so she wanted the love of my grandfather. And that's why she wanted to go live with him. And then she said to me, she chased this man all her life only to be rejected by him. And then she came to realize that she couldn't find happiness through others. She had to find it in herself.
He dumped her at his mother's house,
your great-grandmother's house. Yeah, he shipped my mom off to what was known as the homelands in South Africa. And this was where most black people had to live. So black people couldn't live in the cities. And outside of the cities were slums, essentially, where the workforce was allowed to live. And then most black people lived in areas called the homelands, the Bantustans. And these were places where there was the illusion of sovereignty. But really, the government was just saying, you stay there. We don't build infrastructure. We don't help you. But we give you the illusion that you are in control. And that's where my mom went, and she lived a very, very, very rough life there.
What about schools? Were they better in the Bantustans?
Well, they weren't, but that's again where,
Because they were not good in South Africa.
No, they weren't. They weren't. In South Africa, black people weren't considered worthy, of learning anything. There was one of the quotes, I paraphrase, but, I remember listening to one of the quotes, from one of the architects of apartheid, and I think it was for Voet, and he said, how can you teach the black math and science? He will never use these things. You must teach him what he will learn. He needs to know how to toil the land. He needs to know how to grow vegetables, because this is what the black is knowing how to do. And this is what the law was. Black people didn't need to learn math. Black people didn't need to learn anything beyond the very menial tasks. And so in the Bantustans, my mom was lucky in that she came across a missionary. And at the mission schools, there were people who went against what the government said, and they taught English and they taught math, and they taught subjects that they weren't supposed to be teaching to these kids. And my mom was lucky enough to have that influence in her life.
And she passed that on to you.
She did, definitely.
How did she meet your father? Wasn't it illegal to mingle or walk down the street with someone of a different race?
Yeah, and I think that's part of what drew my mom to it. My mom always says, you show her a ridiculous law and she'll find a way to break it. One of my mom's greatest joys was the passive resistance of apartheid. So there was the marching in the streets, but then there was also the joy of kissing a white man and basically breaking the system, having somebody see that is a couple that is mixed. She loved that, because she always loved the fact that it showed how ludicrous it all was. She was saying, look, I can make you love me. I can break your rules. I can do what you say I cannot do.
Where could they socialize?
There were underground clubs, a lot of them in Hillbrow at the time.
Were they making a political statement, or were they just developed out of necessity?
I think humans were doing what humans were doing. It's similar to the stories I read about New York, when white people would go up to Harlem to hang out in the Negro establishments, as they called it. People want to be together. And so that's what they did in South Africa as well.
But wasn't your mother making much more of a problem for herself than the white foreigners who were there?
Yes, definitely.
She was putting herself in more risk.
Yeah, because if my mother were caught with my father at the time, she would have been sent to jail for longer than he would have. And she was never caught, red-handed, I guess, in the carnal act. But my mom was arrested a few times for being in white areas and white spaces. And then she would be fined or kept in jail. And many times the fine was up to 3 months' salary.
And she then decided she wanted to have a child with a white man. Didn't she realize how difficult that would make both the child's life, yours and hers?
I think in some strange way, my mom didn't even see it as that. That's the interesting thing about humans and stories, is that there are many storylines happening at the same time. My mom didn't want a child from a white man. My mom wanted a child. The man that she was with at the time happened to be white.
Could she have even imagined marrying him?
Oh, no, that was out of the question. And again, two storylines. One was because of a system that didn't allow black and white people to get married. The second was because my father just didn't believe in marriage. And so these are two things that, you know, my mom knew from the beginning. So she didn't try to circumvent that. But she said, I want a child. You know, and my father said, I don't want a child. She said, oh, no, I didn't ask what you wanted. She said, I want a child. All I'm asking is for you to be a sperm donor, and I'll leave you alone. And, you know, I was lucky enough that when I was born, my father wanted to be a part of my life. And so essentially I got the best of both worlds.
I'm speaking with Trevor Noah. His book, Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood, published by Spiegel & Grau. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Trevor Noah, who we know best as a performer, but he's written a book called Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood, published by Spiegel & Grau. Didn't you grow up in your grandmother's house? Wasn't that against the law?
I did. And
was, you know, everything against the law?
Everything was against the law, Lennon. I think you figured out apartheid. Everything was against the law. That's what apartheid was. You know what's funny is I didn't even know that as a child. So I didn't even know that until I was writing the book, in fact. I grew up in my grandmother's house. You know, I spent a lot of time there. And what I didn't know was every black person, every black family had to have a document that was certified by the government. And on that document, you had to list all the family members who lived in the house. And so my grandmother still has hers till this day. And it has her name, my mother's name, my aunt, my uncle, my cousins. And the only person that is missing from that list is me. And my grandmother, I asked her, I said, well, why? And she said, because they would come and they would do random checks at the houses. You know, they were Mbimpis, they called them, I guess, which is a slang term for a snitch or an informant. And these people were deployed by the police to inform on any families or any people breaking any of these laws. And so my grandmother would hide me. And so the police would come and they would do a sweep of the house sometimes, and they would look for anything suspicious, whether it be a freedom fighter, or I don't think they ever expected to find a little mixed race child, you know, so they weren't looking for that per se. But my gran just, she hid me. And as a child, I didn't know. I thought that I was just an indoor child, and I thought they didn't let me go outside because I was really naughty. I never thought that I was in some strange way a prisoner in this world.
This is in Soweto.
This was in Soweto, yes.
And the living conditions you describe are rather horrific. But why did people without cars or indoor plumbing want to have driveways?
Well, you know what's funny is the living wasn't horrific. It's just what it was.
Well, for example, the houses were made of metal.
And oh, no. I mean, we were lucky in that the house was made of metal, but then other rooms we had managed to find like a cheap form of brick to start growing it. You know, one thing my mom always used to say to me, Leonard, was, oh, black people are good at struggling. Like, black people have found ways to create comfort within the confines of a struggle. And so my house was a home that I lived in. It. We didn't have running water. We didn't have plumbing. You know, some of the windows weren't windows. They were pieces of plastic that had been put over a hole in the wall, basically. But over time, we grew it and we painted it and we added plaster and we added bricks. And at some point, it was a little home. And that's where all of us lived together.
Because of the metal, I was wondering if that wasn't the reason you weren't excited when you found out that John Stewart's office had its original ceiling intact, its tin ceiling.
That is the greatest irony in life. You know, you spend your whole life aspiring to, you know, a better life.
And did people aspire to get out of that ghetto as they do in this country?
Yeah, definitely. But what happened in Soweto was interesting, and that was because people never believed that they could get out of Soweto, they instead started making Soweto a better place, which is a beautiful thing that I think a lot of people could apply to any ghetto. And if you look at Soweto today, Soweto became, you know, one of the first black neighborhoods in South Africa, if not the first, I stand to be corrected, where we had a million rand home. And I mean, it's not $1 million, but it's still a million, you know, it's the same as having a $1 million home. It was unheard of in a black area. And this was long after apartheid. But people said, okay, this is what we have. Let's aspire. Let's make this better. Let's build within the confines of what we have. And that's what everybody did.
Didn't your grandparents treat you differently from your cousins?
They did.
Did you feel that was strange as a kid?
They did. And that's where race is such a complicated thing. I always believed that I was the special grandchild because I was me. I never equated it to race. I never thought of it as that. I just thought, I'm Trevor. Grandma loves me the best because I can run fast and I can eat the most food. And that's all my grandmother wanted from me. What I didn't realize was my grandmother and grandfather treated me differently to my cousins who are black because they themselves had been indoctrinated and they themselves had lived through a system that had told them that I was superior to them. And so my grandmother never laid a hand on me. She would discipline the other children physically and she would never, ever, ever hit me. She was petrified. My grandfather, when driving me around, and this was after apartheid, when we now had a car as a family, we had a little Volkswagen Beetle, and my grandfather would drive me around. He always made me sit in the back seat.
And he called you sir.
Yeah, he'd always say, Master. He'd say, Master must sit in the back seat. The master cannot sit in the front. And I'm like, I'm your grandson. And he says, yes, you are my grandson, Master. Now listen to me. And I was like, what a strange relationship I have with this man. He still treated me like a grandson. He still loved me and still would discipline me in terms of telling me what to do or what not to do, but he always referred to me as master.
You say that names were meant to be prophecies. How did you wind up with Trevor?
That's one of the ironies of life, I guess. In African culture, many people believe in naming your child either for who they are or the moment they're born in or what you hope they will become. And so my mother's traditional name, her Xhosa name, is Nombuyiselo, which means she who gives back. You know, my aunt's name is Sibongile, which means we are grateful. And she was the firstborn, and that's why, you know, they called her that. So they were grateful. My uncle's name is Velile, which means one who has popped out of nowhere, the surprise child, because that's what he was. And throughout that time, I guess everyone has lived up to their names. My mother has become the person who gives back. She went on to employ all of the members of our family. She employs people from the community in a business that she started. You know, my aunt went on to be a nurse, one of the most decorated nurses at Barrack Gwynedd Hospital. And, you know, people were grateful for having her. My uncle, till this day, is someone who disappears for weeks on end, you know, struggles with alcoholism, and he pops up when we least expect it. And so everyone had that. And my mom was afraid that I would live up to any name that I gave her. And so she intentionally decided to not give me a name with a meaning or a name that she didn't know had a meaning. And so she said, I will give you a name that means nothing so that you can have a blank slate to work off of, not my expectations for you and not my intentions. And she chose Trevor. And I think the reason she chose it is because at the time she was a big John Travolta fan. And then she went, I can't call you Travolta. Thank God for that. So she called me Trevor. She still calls me Travolta, though, like as a nickname. You know, she'd go like, Travolta. But she doesn't. She called me Trevor. And that's how I got my name.
Well, if she'd called you Travolta, you'd have to have become a Scientologist. My guest is Travolta Noah.
It's not the same, Leonard. It just doesn't sound the same.
Border Crime Stories from a South African Childhood. It is published by Spiegel & Grau. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have an amazing ability, amazing ear for accents. Do you speak any other languages?
I do. I speak six. I lose a few of them if I don't spend enough time speaking them, but they stay in your head. You know, like my German has become horrible now. But if I go to Germany and I spend a week there, my fluency comes back really quickly.
You picked it up while living there?
No. I just learned it after a while. I actually learned it, you know, because my dream was to reconnect with my father. I'd been disconnected from him for a long time. And so I thought I'd learn German and, you know, have that be a special bond between us, only to find that my German was so horrible that he said, listen, this is going to drive us apart. Just speak English and we'll get along. But yeah, I love learning languages. I like traveling to countries where they don't speak English so that I can, you know, put myself in a place where I have to learn a different language, a different culture, a different demeanor as a person. So accents, became a part of that because everyone in my family has a different accent.
Although it's been pointed out that in all throughout Africa, people speak more than one language. Usually they speak the tribal language. They speak the language of the country that colonized them.
Yes.
Perhaps they speak the language of the neighboring
yep.
colony. They
yep.
may speak Swahili
yes.
as well.
Yeah, that's very common. It's also something that I've always loved. I tell people if you learn a language, another language, it does two things to you. One, it helps you communicate with another human being. And Nelson Mandela said it the best. He said, if you speak to a human being in a language they understand, you speak to their head. If you speak to a person in their language, you speak to their heart. And that is something that I found to be true. And so that's the first part. And the second thing is, I find learning new languages like continuously builds humility, because you cannot be arrogant in a new language. You don't possess the tools. You don't even know what the word for arrogance is, but it's a wonderful experience to relearn what it is to make mistakes, to be a child again, to be inquisitive, to think in a completely different way.
In your comedy special, you do a bit about Barack Obama meeting Nelson Mandela and Mandela teaching him how to speak presidentially.
I loved is Nelson Mandela and Barack Obama. I believe they have the same vocal tone. There's a note in their voice that is very similar, and a rhythm that they have that's very similar. And I found it interesting. I always, my conspiracy theory is it's the first black president voice that they both have, because Nelson had the never again, I believe South Africans, we must pursue. You see, like he had that thing, and Barack has his is different, but he's like as Americans we'll try and he's got that. And but if you listen to it, they both have the I believe in, Americans. And I realized that was something, and I played with that, and I guess it was inspired by a picture I saw of the two men meeting for the first time. I think it was in Chicago, a beautiful silhouette of the two of them. And that's where the joke came from.
You also write about your years of criminal activity here. And you say that in the hood, there was a thin line between civilian and criminal. Is it just a matter of perception?
I think it is, for the most part. We live in a world where the best way I've learned to process it is, I think it was a Churchill quote where he said, "History will be kind to me. I know this because I'll write it." Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful way to look at the world, because if you think about it, certain crimes and how we consider crime is defined by the people in power. You look at what's happening now, even if we bring it to modern day. Look at laws. For instance, lobbying in America. I consider that corruption. That's what I consider it, because I come from a country where I see rich businessmen or companies that give money in some way, shape, or form to politicians so that they will change the law in their favor. Not in the favor of the country, not in the favor of the people, but in their favor. And that is corruption, and Africa is one of the most corrupt continents by those standards. But then I came to America.
So is it just more blatant in Africa?
Oh, yeah. The difference is, in America, you have found a way to legalize that corruption, and then it is no longer corruption. And so growing up in the hood, you come to realize that so many things, people go like, oh, the crime-infested ghettos and the inner cities. And I go, I will never, ever take away from the fact that there is crime. But there are so many small things that are a part of life. A mother who buys a stolen box of burger patties, doesn't know where the guy got it from, but here's a man selling food, and the mom buys it for her family. And there's small things that people have found, whereas we've legalized certain things practices that Wall Street go through, practices that corporations go through. We've said that those are legal, and really it's just a rule that we've made up.
You were selling pirated CDs, which some people would call a victimless crime, but then you became a money lender?
I did, yeah.
So were you one of the money lenders who breaks legs?
No. I was a kid at the time. I didn't even think of that. I just realized very quickly that, people needed money around me. And I realized that if I saved my money, I could loan it to them. And then they would either pay me back with the interest, or they would then give me something from their world that they didn't deem as valuable. And then I could go on to sell. So I would loan someone money because they work at a Nike store. And then I would get them to get me Nikes at a discount, but I didn't want the Nikes. I would sell them to someone for full price, and then I just found a way to keep growing money as a person.
You have said that the difference between hustling and working was the difference between reading and
skimming the internet. That's really what it is. It never ends.
Now,
that's,
how did you wind up? We have very little time. Yeah. How did you make the jump from that to becoming a performer?
Oh, I think I was always a performer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just.
But you were hiding for half of your life.
But I performed in the house. You know,
did everybody have a sense of humor in the house?
Oh, definitely. Like my mom, my grandfather. Wow, you could not come into the Noah household and not hear people laughing. It did not matter what was happening outside. We made sure that in our house, laughter was what defined us.
I don't have time to get to all the stories, especially the story about in the final chapter. After your mother had left your stepfather for good reason, and you saw her in the hospital.
After she was shot, yeah.
But I guess that's why people read books.
That is exactly why people read books.
Meanwhile, we'll be seeing you on The Daily Show.
Yes.
And I do have a question about that. How much of it is written by you, and how much of it is written by that brilliant staff of writers you have?
Oh, you know what? I'm lucky enough that we have a brilliant synergy now. So I write the show with my writers. You know, so some shows have it where the writers write and give it to the host. I write the show with my writers. So we sit there from the beginning. Some jokes come literally just from the inside. Some I'm making up as the show is going on. But all of it is us working together to come up with the funniest ideas. And that's how I love creating, with people. It's African culture, Leonard. That's what it is.
One of them is our friend on the show, Neil Brennan,
yes,
who has also guest hosted for me. If you ever decide you want a guest host for me, I'm perfectly happy to have you sit in this chair.
I don't think I have the voice. I genuinely don't think I have the voice.
I think you do, okay. Trevor Noah has written a book called Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood. It is published by Spiegel & Grau. What a pleasure it has been to
Thank
have
you so
on
much again
show.
For having me. Having me before you knew me and having me again after you knew me. I appreciate you. Thank you.